Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Cochran, Judge Kirk, the Honorable Matthew E. Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. For the sake of the audio record, I will say that today's date is March 7, 2024. This panel of the court today has five cases on its agenda, three of which will be submitted with oral argument and two of which will be submitted without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The first case set for oral argument is number A23-1229, Reagan West versus West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. I believe counsel are familiar with our standard procedures. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal argument. Appellant's counsel will have an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal argument. Please, when you approach, by the way, the lectern is adjustable. There's a button on the front edge that, with an electric motor, that will raise it up and down if you wish. Before you begin, please introduce yourself and your client. Counsel for appellant, you may approach and begin.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Paul Otten. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Reagan West, who is not here with me today. She is on vacation instead. We, as you know, this is an appeal from a no-fault arbitration award from a car accident that occurred back in 2020. Had a no-fault arbitration, then I sought to vacate the arbitration award in district court, and that was denied on the 90th day following oral arguments without a memorandum. So we don't have the benefit of the analysis from that. The brux of my argument today, I want to spend the majority of my time on issue number one, the issue of bills that were incurred after the commencement of the no-fault arbitration petition. I'll address issues two and three, basically the replacement services, if I have time, and but the majority of the argument is clearly regarding issue number one. Issue number one is that medical bills were denied because they were incurred after the petition was filed. The no-fault arbitrator awarded all pre-petition medical bills. He denied all post-petition medical bills. In denying the post-petition medical bills, he stated, other medical bills claimed fall outside of the jurisdictional limits of the mandatory no-fault arbitration rules 65B525, subdivision 1, and rule 5A of the Minnesota no-fault arbitration rules, providing for mandatory arbitration for claims of $10,000 or less at the commencement of the arbitration. Arbitrator finds that these newly claimed bills cannot now be brought in this arbitration as they were not included in at the time the original petition was filed and were therefore waived. The arbitrator cited Hippie versus American Family. That arbitration award is at document 35, Exhibit D. He's wrong on every single one of those points that he just made. The case law, the statute, and the arbitration rules stand for the exact opposite of what he said they stand for, specifically.
Mr. Otten, could I stop you just for a minute? So it seems like the arbitrator's reasoning, it depends upon whether the newly claimed bills are liabilities to a medical provider that were, it depends on whether they were incurred before the petition or after the petition. Is that true?
Yes.
And so if these were bills that had arisen after the petition, then that type of reasoning would be correct?
No.
The,
all bills.
Excuse me. What I meant to say is, if the bills had arisen before the petition, then that type of reasoning would be correct.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
It has to be $10,000 or less at the time the petition was filed, and it was. There's no question about.
But I guess my point is that if somebody has. X amount of medical expenses at the time of filing a petition, and they only claim some of them, they can't later on then add them to their claim. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
So I guess it's not clear from the arbitrator's statement on its face when the newly claimed bills were, when those expenses were incurred. But is it clear factually in the record of this case that they were bills that accrued after the petition?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
The petition was filed on July 7th, 2022. It's document 35, Exhibit A. The amended petition was filed August 5th, 2022. Same site for that. The only thing different between the original petition and the amended petition was to take out $2,000 of replacement services and add $2,000 of wage loss.
Did the medical bills that the arbitrator found were outside of the jurisdictional limits, were those all incurred between when July 7th and August 5th?
I believe so, because there's clearly absolutely no doubt that the medical bills were the same amount that were claimed in the petition and the amended petition.
Did the amended petition reset the commencement of the arbitration for purposes of determining the requirement to itemize the expenses?
No. Commencement of the arbitration is governed by Arbitration Rule 5C, which states arbitration is commenced by the filing of the signed form together with the required filing fee with the arbitration organization. And we know that the arbitrator wasn't talking about the amended petition. He never mentioned the amended petition at all in his memorandum. Not once is the memorandum, is the amended petition mentioned. We need to take the arbitrator for what he said. The plain language of what he said is, arbitrator finds that these newly claimed bills, so after the petition, cannot now be brought in this arbitration as they were not included at the time the original petition was filed and were therefore waived, and cites Hippie. HIPPI stands for the HIPPI versus American Family, stands for the proposition, just like Minnesota Statute 65B.525 and No Fault Arbitration Rule 6. All of them say all bills incurred after the commencement of the arbitration can be considered. They're within the jurisdiction of the arbitrator. Rule 6 specifically says, in cases where the amount of the claim continues to accrue after the petition is filed, the arbitrator shall have jurisdiction to determine all amounts claimed, including those in excess of $10,000. So the arbitrator just got it wrong. The arbitrator, this amended petition is not an issue. It wasn't mentioned by the arbitrator and has no bearing here. The claim was filed with the original petition. That's what commenced this. All bills incurred after the date of commencement are specifically allowed by statute, by no-fault arbitration rules.
When you say they're allowed by statute, what statutory language are you relying on?
Minnesota Statute 65B.525 Subdivision 1 states, the Supreme Court and several other courts of general trial jurisdiction of this state shall by rules of court or other constitutionally allowable device provide for the mandatory submission of to binding arbitration of all cases at issue where the claim at the commencement of arbitration is in the amount of $10,000 or less against any insured's reparation obligor for no-fault benefits or comprehensive or collision damage coverage. So in addition to the HIPPI case, the Carrolls versus State Farm and the In Re no-fault benefits against Progressive also stand for the same proposition, that the only way for the court to lose or the arbitrator to lose jurisdiction of the claim is if the original petition did not itemize claims of $10,000 or less, and we clearly did itemize those claims of $10,000 or less. So we don't need to make this any more complicated than it is. There's a statute that is completely on point. There's no-fault arbitration rules that are on point, and there's case law that is directly on point. The no-fault arbitration rule that the arbitrator cited that says that there is no jurisdiction is Rule 5A, which says mandatory arbitration for claims of $10,000 or less at the commencement of arbitration. As such time as the respondent denies a claim, the respondent shall advise the claimant of claimant's right to demand arbitration. That's the full rule that the arbitrator cited to state that the bills after the filing of the petition cannot be considered and they're waived.
How high can the coverage be for this kind of protection? Because it's no-fault protection.
It's no-fault. Right. In this case, it was $20,000 for medical and mileage and $20,000 for wage loss and replacement services. She was at fault, so there's no liability claim. We're here at the Court of Appeals fighting for her medical bills.
So what is that dollar amount that's at issue? Because the $2,458 was found to be covered, right? Or awarded.
Yes.
So what is the additional amount? Can you remind me?
The medical bills that were incurred following the petition, the date of the petition, are itemized in my reply brief on page 3 of that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
If there are no other questions about how the arbitrator, he cited all the right rules and statutes and cases, but they stand for the opposite of what he says, which is excellent lawyering, not by me. I couldn't convince the arbitrator when the law and everything was on my side, but some are talented enough to be able to convince the arbitrator and ultimately, I guess, the district court judge. That
Mr. Auden, I'm sorry to interrupt, but with the last minute, I'd like to ask one or two targeted questions about your second argument,
yes.
Your second issue, that replacement services. Looking again at the arbitrator's decision, it seems like in the latter part of that, let's see, it's about the fifth paragraph. In the latter part of that paragraph, the arbitrator finds that there was no proof of diminution of need for help at home. I'm wondering if that forecloses your, if that finding of fact forecloses your argument. I'm also wondering whether, before the arbitrator, whether your client sought replacement services of both types or only one type?
She's always been the primary homemaker. There was only a primary homemaker claim.
I thought there was also some evidence that she had paid friends or relatives to do some work.
She did, but that doesn't preclude her from being a primary homemaker.
So she's permitted by law to pursue both types of recoveries?
She pursued the primary homemaker claim because she is a primary homemaker.
Okay.
She's the primary homemaker in the household.
So if that's true, this finding of, if I'm reading it correctly, that there was no proof of diminution of need for help at home, how does that affect your argument?
It's not favorable, Your Honor, to be real direct with you. There are three bases for the denial. One was the Rindall case, which he got completely wrong because he didn't apply the primary homemaker statute. The other area of law that he got wrong was Minnesota Statute 65B.55, Subdivision 1. He said that prevented her from collecting, when that was just a statute that deals solely with filing the application for benefits within 6 months. The reason I cited issues 2 and 3 are to again show you how this arbitrator got the law so wrong in Rindall and 65B.55, in addition to all of the cases and arbitration rules and statute that he got wrong in issue number 1. But we rest our case primarily on issue number 1 with the understanding he messed up on the law in the replacement services as well. But okay. I understand the point there.
Well, yeah, maybe, I'm not sure if you've answered my question, I guess, but I'll re-ask it. First of all, are you still pursuing an argument, your second argument, that there was error with respect to replacement services? And if so, how could we grant appellate relief in light of the finding that I identified?
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. Yes, we are pursuing issues 2 and 3. They're not as strong as issue number 1 for the reason that you cited. He was wrong on the two areas of law that he cited. Whether your honors believe that is what drew him to the conclusion to deny the wage law, the replacement services claim, is your call. We know that he got two out of three of them wrong. Your Honor has cited the third. Our argument is he relied on his misunderstanding of the statute and of Rindall to draw that conclusion that he drew.
Thank you, Mr. Otten. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you can approach and begin.
Good morning. My name is Jeannie Provo-Peterson, and I am here on behalf of respondent West Bend Mutual Insurance Company. May it please the court, counsel. As you were told, this is an appeal from a Dakota County District Court order which confirmed a November 16th, 2022 no-fault arbitration award. With all due respect, the arbitrator did not get it wrong, which is why the District Court confirmed the arbitration award. And we are asking this court to affirm the District Court's order of June 20th of 2023 in all respects, which also confirmed the arbitration award. There are two standards of review that I asked the court to look at in this case, both a de novo standard of review, which obviously is going to apply to the questions of law that appellate's counsel has just identified. But there are mixed questions of law and fact here with respect to some of the factual findings by the arbitrator, which would be an abuse of discretion standard. Unusually, we did have an award from the arbitrator with a memorandum. Neither of us asked the arbitrator to prepare a memorandum, but he did so.
So turning to the medical expenses, the denial of the medical bills that were not listed with the initial arbitration filing, would you agree that Rule 6 of the Minnesota Rules of No-Fault Arbitration provides that in cases where the amount of the claim continues to accrue after the petition is filed, the arbitrator shall have jurisdiction to determine all amounts claimed, including those in excess of $10,000?
I do agree, Your Honor, with that statement, as it happens often.
So appellant is arguing that I think that the arbitrator erred by not applying that rule and not awarding medical bills that accrued after the original arbitration filing. Why doesn't that rule allow for the award of those bills that medical bills that were accrued after July 7th?
Because Your Honor was correct. He filed an amended petition. And when you said, does that reset? Yes, it does.
And what law provides that it resets? Because I didn't see any clear language providing for a reset. So help me, I understand your argument there.
I will do my best, Your Honor. It's our position on behalf of a respondent that when you apply Rule 5 in conjunction with Rule 6, there is no dispute that all claims have to be $10,000 or less at the time of filing. Rule 5F also requires then once they file, if they are going to waive claims to keep it within the jurisdictional limit of $10,000, they must do so in writing within 30 days. The rule also provides that they have to provide documentation with that.
They include that listing when they initially filed?
They did not claim in the initial filing wage loss, and the only bill claimed was the McGraw chiropractic bill, which was what the arbitrator awarded.
But they did include an itemization, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
The amended petition was filed on August 5th of 2022. The amended petition reduced the replacement service claim by $2,000 and added a wage loss claim. The McGraw chiropractic bill remained the same. So the claimant wants to suggest, well, that was just an amendment. We substituted a wage loss claim. Why did you not substitute all of the bills that predated that amended petition? They particularly reduced the replacement service claim because they knew they had to comply with the $10,000 jurisdictional limit. The other problem that they had with adding the new claims is they never amended it further. If they had amended that amended petition within 30 days or supplied the additional bills, we might not be here today. Those bills were not supplied until November 9th, which was 5 days before the hearing. So there was no notice of the providers, there was no notice of the bills, and these bills predated the amended petition. If we are to accept the appellant's argument as true, that the original petition controls, then why did he amend the petition to reduce the claim to keep within the $10,000 jurisdictional limit? The Hippie case, just jumping ahead, because that's one of the crux of their arguments. The Hippie case was concerned. The Minnesota Supreme Court specifically said we are concerned with the manipulating of claims in order to meet the jurisdictional limit to keep, and at that time the claim limit was $5,000. But we are concerned about that. And after Hippie, Minnesota Statute 65B.525 Subdivision 1 was amended to raise the limit to $10,000. Also, Rules 5 and 6 in the Minnesota No-Fault Arbitration Rules, which are adopted by the Minnesota Supreme Court, were also changed. And that's where the requirement of Rule 5F is, you must expressly state what your claims are to meet the $10,000 jurisdictional limit. If you're going to waive claims, you have to expressly itemize what those are. HIPPI doesn't stand for the proposition that claims can continue to incur. It stands for the proposition, yes, if the arbitrator has original jurisdiction, if those bills that were, as Your Honor said, in the gap period had been claimed on the amended petition, they could continue to accrue and he would have jurisdiction.
HIPPI didn't involve an amended petition, though, correct?
No. HIPPI involved.
The issue was whether the wage loss had already accrued by the time she filed her petition.
That was the Carroll's case, Your Honor. But HIPPI also involved both two petitions. One
right.
For, yes, Your Honor is correct. Yes. Yes. And then the Carroll's case, that's what their position is, that you know, allows the case claim to continue to accrue. The Carroll's case, yes, there was a $2,000 and some claim for medical bills. After the hearing, the wage loss, these were new dates for wage loss. Wage loss accrued after the hearing. That's not what we have here. The medical bills, the wage loss, and the replacement services that are being claimed and that are the subject of this appeal predated. Some predated the petition.
Well, they didn't predate July 7th, though, right?
Some of the replacement services claims and the wage loss. That's why he amended the petition. But
okay.
But you are correct.
I was focusing on the medical.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, you are correct. That gap period. And I believe that Your Honor is correct when you said, does it reset? Well, yes, that's why you amended it, and that's why you still made sure your amended petition was within the jurisdictional limit. Why not just list those bills?
So would you agree that neither HIPPI nor Carroll's involved an amended petition?
Correct.
And is there any guidance about amending petitions?
The claim, one of the cases that we cited was the Grinnell Mutual case, because the issue is, what is a claim? And what the Grinnell Mutual case stands for, the proposition that the claim includes everything that is outstanding at the time of filing. Everything, whether it's been denied or not. So they define what that claim was. So it's the total aggregate is what the Grinnell Mutual case stands for. We cited that in our materials, and I can provide Your Honor with the citation if you wish. But the total aggregate of all claims, whether denied or not. The other case that deals with this jurisdictional issue, which was cited by, I believe, both of us, but I know we cited it, specifically talks about Rule 6, and that was the Charbonneau case. And that,
right.
Yeah, that says that Rule 6 grants an arbitrator jurisdiction, which is exactly what Your Honor identified, to determine all amounts claimed, including those in excess, if those claims continued to accrue after the date of filing for arbitration.
But with regard to the medical claims, that didn't change in the amended petition.
They did. All of those new providers, the only...
Well, I'm sorry. In the amended petition, did the I thought you said that the amount that they listed was the same as in the original petition.
Right. It was, I did, Your Honor, because it was the one bill, McGraw right. Chiropractic. It's these other providers, which are itemized in both of our materials, the Reyes Radiology, which was MRIs, Twin City Pain. These are all brand-new providers that were never listed nor never known on the petition, the amended petition, and only came up by way of their arbitration submissions on November 9th. These were not only new bills, Judge, they were new providers that had never been known.
Could and you help?
I'm sorry.
Could you help me understand why the amendment of the petition is the type of manipulation that was discouraged by HIPAA? How is it beneficial or potentially beneficial to the claimant to make the amendment 1 month later?
Because what they're doing, complying with rule, that's what they did by amending the petition, is to comply with Rule 5E and 5F. The manipulation happens with what we are seeing now. So rather than what we assumed to be a $2,000 chiropractic bill is the only medical bill in issue, at arbitration, suddenly we're facing a claim of $12,000, including these.
But if they hadn't amended the petition, wouldn't Rule 6 allow them to still ask for those additional amounts in the arbitration?
The arguments may have been different. Judge, you may be right, but the arguments, and as you saw, we submitted a 40-some page arbitration statement of the case detailing every single argument we're raising today, because the arguments would have been noticed. There's another rule, which is not the subject of our issue today, but Rule 12 of the Minnesota No-Fault Arbitration Rules requires disclosure and discovery. These were all, we sent a detailed, which attached this as an exhibit to our materials, but we sent a detailed list requesting an itemization of all claims. And that was one of the issues that was raised in that Stowelli District Court case that we provided. The example I can give is, you know, thinking of trying a case by surprise. Minnesota, we don't do that. You have to give notice, especially when we ask. And we sent a two-page letter asking, identify all claims that you'll submit at the hearing. So 5 days before the hearing, when everybody's briefed the case and gotten records and investigated the claim, is a problem. The other component of why is a problem and a manipulation, in this case, it was particularly troublesome because dealing with issue two very quickly in my 3 minutes remaining, Your Honors, is this issue of trial by surprise and arbitration by surprise. In the documents submitted by the claimant, all the way up until she filed her petition for arbitration and her amended petition, there was no wage loss claim. She's listed in her application for benefits, and that gets to this notice issue. She says, not applicable. She writes it on there. And these documents are all supplied as part of the record, and they were supplied at the hearing. Westman followed up by email asking, no wage loss. And 2 years later, suddenly now, there's a replacement service claim and a wage loss claim. So the issue of prejudice and manipulation of the system comes with what the arbitrator was troubled by, manipulating the system to retroactively claim wage loss and replacement services. There's two ways to claim replacement services. The one is the primary homeworker case, Rindall, and that says you don't have to incur usual expenses. But he leaves out the second part of that statute. You have to be injured, and that's what the Schrader case dealt with. The Schrader case dealt with an elderly woman who was very injured. She didn't have anybody to come perform services, and the court allowed that, saying she couldn't perform services. She's entitled to that value. Rindall was a farm wife who had the same situation, but she was injured. There was no demonstrable evidence of injury in this case, and that went to your question, Judge, about diminution. And that's what the arbitrator was troubled by. The documents were retroactive. They didn't come. They were dated 2 years later and submitted retroactively going back 2 years. The other thing I would point out, that between the original petition and the amended petition, the replacement service claim started the day of on the petition. By the time the amended petition, it went back to a year later. So the first petition, we're claiming wage replacement services as of October of 2020. The second, it's as of October of 2021. Manipulating the dates.
Okay, I don't understand. I think why the amendment was potentially beneficial, because as Judge Cochran's earlier question noted, that She could still recover future medical, or, you know, the reoccurring medical bills that continue on while the claim is pending. So I don't see why it was, I don't see why it made a difference or why it was to her advantage to do the amendment, and therefore I don't see why it was manipulated. Like, I can't see it as manipulation until I can understand why it was beneficial for her to do the amendment.
Because the itemization of claim that would have vastly over. In fact, there's documentation in the record showing that both the replacement service claim and the wage loss claim was vastly over the $10,000. And so they had to itemize and waive those portions to keep within that $10,000.
And was there a waiver in this case?
The waiver, it was not an itemized waiver, but it was listed in their claim. So they didn't do an itemization saying we waive X, Y, and Z. Rather, what they did is say our itemization are these expenses, which equal $10,000. So it accomplished the same purpose.
And I was also wondering whether, I think there's a rule that requires itemization and waiver of any excess amounts within 30 days, right?
You are correct. Rule 5E and 5F.
I mean, I was wondering whether the amended petition accomplished the same purpose as that rule requiring itemization and waiver.
It did, because it itemized the claims that they were claiming, which did not include any of the medical bills that were before that amended petition, and it changed the wage loss and the replacement services. The amended petition doesn't affect what the arbitrator found with respect to the wage loss and replacement services. The arbitrator denied those claims for lack of evidence, and that's exactly what his memorandum states. In our brief and in our statement of the case and all of the documents that were supplied, it was a credibility issue and a veracity issue for what the question was about, you know, how much was at issue, but also the conflicting documentation and the conflicting testimony. And I think our brief fully sets that forth. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Provost-Peterson. Mr. Otten, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So many things to address. There is no mention of an amended petition in the memorandum by the arbitrator. The district court didn't issue a memorandum, so we don't know what the district court thought, so we can't attribute that. The arbitrator says in his denial of the bills that they were denied because they were not in the original filing. That's the one and only basis for the denial. There's no talk about amended petition.
Well,
this is
but it was clearly before the arbitrator. So can we talk about the amendment process and why the amended petition was filed and why it didn't include the new the medical expenses that had been incurred since the original petition?
Yes, Your Honor.
Because that would have pushed you over the $10,000. You couldn't have included, if you included, maybe I'm wrong, but it looks to me like if you had included those additional medical expenses, you couldn't have included replacement services or lost wages, at least to the extent you did in the amended petition. Is that correct?
Okay, a number of things there. The only thing that the amended petition did was take out $2,000 of replacement services and add $2,000 of wage loss instead. It did nothing other than that. There was no need to get to any jurisdictional limit. That wasn't a factor at all.
Why was that change made?
Yeah, that's a good question. If I had to do it again, I wouldn't have done that. But she was an at-fault driver. She retained us late in the process after her benefits were cut off. She wasn't aware of what benefits were available. We didn't understand that there was a wage loss until the very end, after we had quickly put the petition together because it time was of the essence to get to the $10,000. And we did get to the $10,000. And counsel acknowledges that. in page 3 of her brief when she says the petition totaled $10,000, the jurisdictional limit required of arbitration. So there's no question that that was made. But no, Your Honor, we do not have to itemize in the amended petition additional medical bills that accrued, because again, the issue is commencement. That all bills according to Rule 6 are within the jurisdiction, even though they go over and above $10,000. Rule 6 clearly states that. So the additional bills that were incurred during that month didn't need to be amended. They were already allowed to be brought in because they were done so after the commencement of the arbitration. Just so we're absolutely clear, we're not claiming any bills pre-petition that go over the $10,000. All bills besides mileage and the chiropractor that we claimed were incurred post-commencement of the petition, and some of them were incurred post-amended petition. But again, the arbitrator just said none of that can be considered because they weren't included with the original petition. And that's where he's wrong. And I with all due respect, we're going down a path that isn't something that the arbitrator considered. If the arbitrator would have concluded that the bills couldn't be awarded because they were between the petition and the amended petition, he could have said that. He didn't say that. He said, and he didn't address about bills post-amended petition, because that's not where he was coming from. He was coming from the place that if it wasn't in the original petition, it can't be included now. And the statute says that, and the case law says that, and the arbitration rules say that. And he's wrong about every single one of them. I see my time is up. If there's no other questions, I'll sit.
Thank you, Mr. Otten.
Thank you
to both attorneys for your arguments. The case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion in writing within 90 days.